You are listening to the Roberta Glass True Crime Report, putting the true back in true crime. From New York City, Roberta Glass is now on the record. My guest, Susan Dones, has a master's in psychology from Antioch University. Dones joined NXIVM in 2000, eventually opening up her own center in Tacoma, Washington. She taught NXIVM classes in Mexico and Ireland before leaving the group in 2009. How did you get into NXIVM?
It's such a funny story. I was at another training seminar, and the woman that was doing the training seminar, two of my friends and I were looking at bringing her out to the Pacific Northwest to work with a group of our friends. And we had heard about her training seminar. She was in Detroit, Michigan, and it was called Life Skills. So we had called her and said, hey, would you come out to the Seattle area and do your workshop out in Seattle? And she said, well, why don't you fly out and take my program and see if you really think it's good. We had heard about her through a network of friends. So we flew out there, and it was a three-day seminar. It was Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And we were there. And then she'd made this big announcement from the front of the room that she was shutting down her training program. And she was going to Albany, New York to study with Nancy Salzman and Keith Raniere in a program called Executive Success Programs. And we all looked at each other like, what? Like, what? You know, we came out here to bring her out to the Pacific Northwest, and she's shutting down her company. And then she talked about it a little bit. And there were people from, you know, like all over the United States there. And we all kind of started looking at each other and thought, wow, you know, she has a successful training program. And if she's shutting down her company to go study with these people in Albany, New York, yeah, it's got to be something. And so she invited us to get on to, you know, a couple of conference calls. And you know, we listened to these conference calls, and at first I wasn't going to go because it was $6,000 in 16 days. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's a lot of money and stuff. But my two friends decided they were going to go. And I thought, wow, well, maybe I'm missing out on something. And so I decided to go. And on the conference calls, they were looking at opening satellite centers at the time.
Was Nancy Salzman teaching the 16-day program you did?
Yeah, well, it was the second only. It was the very second 16-day program they ever taught. And so it was like very in the very, very early days. And so, you know, I had a wellness center, and a part of my goal at my wellness center was to have an educational program where people could kind of not only heal their bodies kind of thing, but, you know, we had an eclectic group of people at my wellness center, but also to have a, you know, a training program where people could kind of come heal their emotional stuff through a training program. So I was looking for a training program. You know, I didn't want to invent one. I just, you know, because there were a lot of good ones out there, but I wanted one that was a good training program where people could kind of come heal their body, mind, and soul kind of thing. And so I was on the hunt for a program that I could incorporate into our training facility, or into our wellness facility that we had.
What about the program appealed to you?
I liked the way it was packaged, you know, because it was a second only 16-day program and they hadn't enrolled the Brofmans yet. And Keith was this obscure man that they kind of kept in the background kind of thing. You know, he came in and did on day five, it was New Year's Eve. And he came in and did a forum, and a lot of people thought, wow, he's like this interesting, like, isn't he so interesting? He has these profound things to say. And I thought, are you guys are kidding? He's like this geeky looking chubby kind of guy. And I found it to be really boring, you know? And to me, he didn't say anything that was profound or anything that was new, or in the training program wasn't anything that was new and innovative to me. It was just packaged really well, made a lot of sense in it. I like the inductive process to it. You know, instead of somebody standing up at the front of the room doing the big blah, blah, blah all day long and, you know, selling tapes and books at the back of the room at the end of the day where people rush to buy the books and the tapes and stuff like that. Nancy taught a little part of the module, and then they would break you out into breakout groups and ask you a set of questions where everybody got to answer the set of questions, you know. And so instead of getting like Nancy Salzman's or whoever the head trainer's take on whatever the question was, you got to listen to everybody's idea and concept of what the question was. And then you would come back to the group, and then Nancy Salzman would do a debrief on that, the set of questions. And then she would teach the next part of the module. And then they would break you out into breakout groups with a coach and stuff like that. So I like the inductive nature of the program. And so, and they had quirky things like the first class was rules and rituals, you know, like you read the mission statement, and you bowed to the room when you came into it. But I had taken martial arts when I was growing up, so I bowed to the dojo when you came in. And the thing about Vanguard and Prefect, you know, like, you know, you called the sensei, you didn't call him Bob Smith. Mm-hmm. If you were at a function, you'd say, hey, Bob, you know, that kind of thing. But when you were taking classes, you would say, you know, Sensei Smith kind of thing. And so, and then I was also in the military, you know, and so you would call somebody, you know, Petty Officer Jones. So that stuff wasn't unusual to me. It was normal for me, that kind of thing. So it didn't bother me that much that they had that in their training program. I was kind of like, you know, oh, this is just a thing to teach people order and respect and stuff like that kind of thing. So those kinds of things didn't bother me. Other people were really bothered by it. And some people left over it and, you know, oh, this is a cult. People left from it. And I'm kind of like, well, you know.
And don't they have a part where they explain or they ask what people in our society wear uniforms, right?
Yeah. Like the Brownies and the Girl Scouts and they went into the military and stuff like that. And they asked questions like that. They didn't say like, you know, well, don't the Brownies wear uniforms? They would ask, you know, well, what other people in societies do that? You know, and I'm the one who brought up karate. Because as you go up the ranks in karate, you wear different color belts, you know, so sashes didn't bother me. They didn't bother me until I qualified for promotion and I didn't get it.
Mm-hmm. You know? Also, I think what people don't understand about Nancy Salzman is she's really one of the best neurolinguistic programmers out there.
Mm-hmm.
And you've taught Nexium classes quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So do they teach you neurolinguistic programming? Do they tell you it's neurolinguistic programming?
They don't do that. What they do is they teach you it's executive success programs, that it's part of the technology that Keith created, but it really isn't, you know, that kind of thing. It's a hodgepodge of different programs that they've brought together. And that's the way I looked at it, is like, oh, this is taken from that, and this is taken from this, and oh, that's part of Milton Erickson, and oh, this is, you know, definitely comes from Tony Robbins stuff. When you've taken a lot of different coursework and stuff like that, you can see where they've taken different things. And that's why after I left, I started doing a lot of research, and their patents were actually turned down in 2003 because it was too much like other stuff that was out there.
A lot of it was taken from Scientology.
I don't know a lot about Scientology because I never dove into that after I left. I had enough of my own cult experience to dive into other cults and like, oh, how's this similar? But that I think they really extorted out of people. And that was kind of a hard habit to break after I left, because I have somebody come over to do something for me. I always wanted to like make sure, like I had gotten really ill and a friend of mine's husband was a plumber and he came over and changed my hot water heater for me. And, you know, I wanted to pay him. And he said, look, Susan, I'm recovering from cancer and people did a lot of things for me. And I'm like, well, I want to pay you, you know, and I had a lot of time off of work without pay. And he's like, no, I want to do this for you. You know, it's like paying it forward kind of thing. And I felt so bad about not paying him.
Mm-hmm. So it's the idea that nothing is free, that you always sort of give something and get something.
Yeah.
And, is the goal executive success or is it personal growth in these classes?
I think it was both. When I went in, it was called executive success programs. And they didn't change it to Nexium till many years later. And really, they said it was like an umbrella group, but really it was more of the fact that executive success programs had been drugged through the media in such a bad way. And, you know, they tried to sell it to everybody that they were changing the name to Nexium because it was going to be an umbrella group, because they were going to start other programs. they were just coming up with a big lie to everybody.
Oh, that's interesting. That's the first time I've heard that.
Yeah.
So I've been asked this so many times. What does NXIVM mean?
Well, it doesn't really mean anything.
Okay.
I've heard a bunch of different things because I said, why are you naming it? Why are you naming it after a digestive pill? It's spelled differently, but at the time they had just started coming out with NXIVM, the digestive medicine. And I said, why are you guys naming it after a digestive thing? And it was supposed to be Roman numerals, like the next millennium kind of thing. And I said, well, that doesn't make any sense to me. And I said, I think you guys are badly packaging it, because at that time they were really pushing NXIVM, the pill for digestive issues. And I'm like, you know, this is bad marketing from the get-go.
There's a real emphasis on personal disclosure, but also secrecy. Can you talk about that?
Well, they really got cautious about who came and why. When I first went in, they kind of just wanted a lot of people to come in. And they didn't really scrutinize why and who and stuff like that. Like, I had a master's degree, and a couple of years later, they would have never allowed me to come in, because people with master's degree got really, you know, like, well, this isn't new and this isn't innovative and stuff like that. And I never pushed the envelope with them in regards to that, because like I said, you know, I thought it was a good program and it helped people make breakthroughs. I mean, I made some breakthroughs, even though I had done a lot of my own personal growth prior to that. And I really believed that the program was good. And had it been just kept pure and not had this cult thing in the background, I think it could have been a really good thing on the planet. I kept my training facility really clean. And when I noticed that things were not good in Albany, I really fought to keep the culture in Albany out of my training facility.
That's what I heard from a lot of people, that your center was very different than Albany. Is that just because Keith Raniere was so far away?
I think it's because the way I ran my center, you know, I knew things weren't good in Albany and that a lot of people were being abused and used. And I didn't want that happening at my center. Matter of fact, when people like Lauren or the Brofmans or Nancy would come back, I would just go into kind of a state of panic, like, what the hell are they going to do back here? You know, who are they going to try to steal to get to move back to Albany and stuff like that? And like when people at my center would say, you know, oh, I'm going to go to Albany to take the last 11 days, I would pull them in the back room and say, okay, this is what's going to happen when you go back there. They're going to find your weaknesses or what, you know, your passions are. And they're going to say, you know, oh, if you move to Albany, we can help you break through this, or we can help you achieve this and stuff like that. And I said, don't buy it. I said, if you tell them I'm telling you this, they're going to kick my butt around the block a few times and I'm going to lose something. I'll lose my next promotion, or I'll lose a stream of income. And I said, and I'm not asking you to keep the secret, because I don't want to put you in that position. You can tell them whatever you want, because, you know, keeping secrets is a hard thing for people to do. I said, you can do whatever you want with this information, but they're going to use and abuse you. They want you back there because they have a hard time getting people to work back there. And they're going to promise you the moon, but they're going to get you to farm set for Claire, or they're going to get you to work in the cafe for $15 an hour. And they're never going to help you achieve whatever dream you have. And they'll lie to you to get you to come back there. And I said, I've seen it happen so many times to people who live like in Mexico or Canada or whatever, or you fit into Keith's profile sexually. You know, and he's going to want to try to get you to bed him. And I said, I'm just being honest with you about what's going on. I said, it's not nice back there. It's not pretty. I said, there's a lot of bad things happening.
Wow. This is one of the few times where I'm just really shut down. What I'm hearing is that you're in a position, you have your own center and you love it. You like the program.
Yeah.
But it's connected to a lot of really ugliness. So it's like you're kind of balancing. It's a very awkward, odd, weird position. So you're trying to protect your students. The thing you like is connected to a lot of bad behavior and about what a crazy position to be in.
Well, their collateral over me was my debt. So I went into a lot of debt to open up the center and to keep it open. And because of the way, you know, it was a Ponzi scheme. And so the way it was set up financially is I had created and got into a lot of debt. So I was buying back the dollar is what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to take me 6 years to get out of debt.
Oh, I'm so sorry. And so when you're setting up the center, it's all on your own dime?
Yeah.
Is that how it works?
Yeah.
And Kristen Snyder was a friend of yours. Can you talk about her and the circumstances around her death?
Well, I was asked to go help coach her first 5-day up in Alaska. And so I went up because it was a pretty large intensive. And because I live close to Alaska, Nancy Salzman was head training it. So she asked me if I would fly up and help train the 5-day. And so I went up and I met her. And so we got along really, really well because we had a lot of things in common. We were both in lesbian relationships and we both loved the outdoors. And so we hit it off really well from day one. And so we spent a lot of time together during that first 5 days. And when you're in that kind of environment, you really get to know somebody really well. And so we just hit it off and developed this close bond. And I met her wife, Heidi. She'd come in for an introduction. And then Heidi was going to take the next intensive. And Kristen took the first 16 days intensive. And then I happened to be in Albany, New York. I was head proctoring intensive that Lauren Salzman was teaching. And lo and behold, Kristen Snyder walks into the center in Albany, New York. And I'm like, well, like, what are you doing here? And she said, well, I was back on the East Coast visiting my parents. You know, I thought I would stop into the mothership. At that time, we were joking around calling Albany the mothership. And she said, I thought I'd stop into the mothership and spend a few days here taking some ethos courses. And she was excited. She was going to repeat the 16-day intensive back in Alaska. And she said, I want to become a coach and stuff like that. And as far as I knew, Alaska was a semi-safe kind of place. You know, I had flown up to Alaska a few times to help their ethos program and coached a lot of people in Alaska and stuff like that. And I asked her where she was staying, and she said, Esther Chapone's house. And the hair on the back of my head kind of stood up. Because Esther was kind of in a dark place. And Esther had flown she took her first 16-day intensive with me. And Esther was at the Detroit training with me, where the woman was saying, I'm going to close my training facility and go to Albany and study with Nancy Salzman and Keith Raniere. And so Esther, I noticed right away, was attracted to Keith. And before I knew it, Esther was divorcing her husband and moving her 4 kids under the age of 10 to Albany, New York, I suspected to be with Keith. Then later on, I found out that that was indeed the truth. And it was at that 5-day intensive in Anchorage that Esther pulled me aside and we had a couple hour conversation. And she told me that Keith and Nancy were not the people we thought they were, and that she had moved to Albany to be with Keith, but then found out that he was not monogamous and that she was not going to have a non-monogamous relationship with Keith. So we spent a couple hours talking about that, and that he was actually very angry about the fact that she had broken it off with him. And then the next morning, Nancy cornered me in the bathroom and said, "What did Esther tell you?" And I was scared to death. I mean, you have never met somebody so angry as Nancy Salzman. I was like a little mouse in the corner of the bathroom, but I didn't want to get Esther in trouble. And I told Nancy the truth, but I didn't tell her the whole truth. And I said, oh, well, we just talked about her kids and what it was like for her to be in Albany, which was all the truth. We had talked about all of that, but I didn't tell her what she said about Keith.
Uh-huh. You just admitted.
Yeah, I admitted the whole part of it. So because I didn't want to get Esther in trouble and I didn't want Nancy to know that I knew about Keith. Although I had suspected that whole thing about Keith anyways, because you can tell when a man and a woman have sexual energy between them. And Keith never hid that. And so I suspected Keith was, you know, sleeping with several women, which I thought was inappropriate. And later on, I started asking Nancy, you know, like, well, is Keith sleeping with her? And she would look at me like with daggers and she'd say, we don't talk about that. And I'd say, well, why? You know, if he's sleeping with her, like, what's the big deal? You know, and she'd say, well, we just don't talk about things like that because, you know, people couldn't handle that. And I'd say, well, I think it's inappropriate for him to be sleeping with students. But, you know, if he is, you know, why isn't it above board? You know, he doesn't hide it well, is what I told Nancy. So if he's going to hide it, he should hide it better. And she would just go off on me about it. And I said, well, it's the truth, you know. I don't know why you guys pretend to hide it, because he doesn't hide it well.
And he went after Kristen Snyder. Why do you think Keith was so interested in Kristen Snyder?
Well, later on, Nancy told me that Keith loved to convert lesbians. And there was another woman in NXIVM. Her name is Siobhan Holstein. And Nancy told me that he had converted her, but he didn't do a very good job because she went back to sleeping with girls. I asked Nancy, I said, so do you think Keith is going to come after me? And she said, oh, no, Keith won't come after you. She said, you're too defiant. I said, yeah, I think I am. I said, but I know he's interested in coming after my wife. So I said, but I don't think that's ever going to happen. But it's funny because Nancy tried to come after me.
That was one of my questions. So Nancy Salzman came after you. Did anyone else in NXIVM hit on you?
No, Nancy tried to push Karen Unterreiner onto me, but that didn't work either. So I don't even know if Karen was sexually attracted to me, but Nancy kept saying, Karen Unterreiner has a big crush on you. And I'd be like, well, that's not going to happen. But Nancy was so inappropriate with me. And I talked to my wife about it. And I said, you know, it's nothing is ever going to happen. And she said, well, I know you and I trust you, but you know, like we'd be riding in her car and she'd reach over and she'd rub the inside of my leg and she'd be like, when we have sex, you could never talk about it. And I would, at first I just started to freeze up because I didn't know how to handle that.
Wow. Do you think that was to control you?
Oh yeah. I think it was an assignment from Keith to her is what I think. But Pam Cafords was the one who first came to me about it. And she said, you know, Nancy's really lonely. She's the prefect. There's not a lot of people she can be close to. And, you know, she really needs a friend. And I said, well, I could be a friend to her. But I didn't know. You know, I had no idea what was going on. And then Nancy came in and did this thing with me in her car. And then she just kept it up for a few months. It was during the first Van V weekend. It was a weekend. It was a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday thing. And she called me and she said, why don't you come to Albany a week early and you can stay at my house? And I said, what? And she said, yeah, you've earned the right to stay at my house. And I thought, oh my God, please, I don't want to stay at your house. So then I talked to my wife about it. She said, well, you'll be okay. And I said, but I don't want to stay at her. Like, what if she crawls in my bed at night? I just don't want to stay at her house.
Yeah. I mean, just from going to court, the two people that stick out to me as different, not including Ranieri, it's Nancy Salzman and Claire Brompton. There's something very dark.
Yeah.
Very dark. I mean, they come off to me as sociopathic,
yeah.
Predatory. I'm with you. The idea of being anywhere close with Nancy Salzman for any amount of time is a little...
Oh, she was so abusive to me. I'm still in therapy over it. But yeah, so I finally just kind of stood up to her and I just said, you know, this is inappropriate. And I said, in any other company, this would be grounds for sexual harassment. I said, you need to stop. I said, this is never going to happen.
Wow.
Between us, you know, and then she, oh my God, she just blew a gasket. They took away head trainer from me. Then it took me like 4 years to get my next promotion. And then I never got to senior proctor and I had been qualified for years for it.
Wow. Can you talk about the circumstances around Kristen Snyder's death and what you think happened to her?
Yeah. After I saw her in Albany, then she started her second intensive. And I didn't hear anything about the intensive until I heard that she had committed suicide. The first thing out of my mouth was like, what? Like, no, I was just like totally dumbfounded. Like, I couldn't believe that she had committed suicide. And then there was a conference call that Nancy did that anybody who wanted to get on the conference call could get on the conference call. You know, they explained how she had gone out to, you know, taken this kayak out and into Deception Pass and had, you know, paddled her way out there. And then so I just started doing research. You know, and I called people in Alaska that I knew, and I'm like, how could this happen? You know, and then, you know, I tried to talk to Esther Chapone and Kinnam about it because they were the head trainers, and neither one of them would talk to me about it. And I'm like, you know, like, why didn't you get her help? And, you know, like nobody, it was like everybody just clammed up and stuff. And I just couldn't believe that because she just seemed so solid in herself. but nobody would talk about it. That's why when Frank Perlato did The Lost Women in NXIVM, I helped him with that. I actually got to meet her mom and her sister. You know, I got to read some of her journal writings and stuff like that. And I just, to this day, I do not believe she committed suicide. I believe that she probably was pregnant with Keith's baby and that they probably did something to her. I, to this day, believe she didn't commit suicide.
One of the things that you talked about at Keith Raniere's sentencing in your victim impact statement was the videotape statement by Keith Raniere that he had had people killed.
Mm-hmm.
And you asked if you were maybe next, or I'm sorry, I don't want to misquote you.
Yeah.
But you asked if it could be you. I mean, why do you believe him? And is it just Kristen Snyder? I mean, what do you think the extent of that is? And
mm-hmm. Well, I think I'm safe now, but I spent a lot of time with Nancy Salzman. Every time we went to Albany, which was a lot because I was a center owner and I was a field trainer. And so they had constantly had meetings in Albany for center owners and field trainers. So I was in Albany once or twice a month. And every time I went to Albany, Nancy would always summons me to her house. And one, because I was a massage therapist. So one of the forced labor things I turned in is she would always make me give her massages. And she would always promise to pay me, but she never did. You know, she was going to take it off money I owed them for level 2 trainings and stuff like that. But it never came to fruition that I ever got paid for those. And then she also would confess things to me. And I don't know if it was just to torture me or if she just felt a need to offload onto somebody. So she would tell me things like, you know, she told me about Keith losing the Brofman's money in the commodities market and the debacle real estate dealings in California with Keith and the Brofman's money and stuff like that. And the decision that I made to finally leave NXIVM was long before the NXIVM 9 ever met. I was at Nancy Salzman's house and she was highly agitated. And I learned early on that if I could find a way to calm her down, that I was in for quite a lashing from her. And so I kept asking her, you know, what's going on? And she was trying to put me off about what was going on with her. And finally I said, look, you know something's going on with you. Just tell me what's going on and you'll feel better. And she said, kept saying, I can't talk about it. I can't talk about it. And finally I said, look, just talk to me about what's going on with you. Just get it out because you're about ready to explode. And it's never good for me when you just explode if you don't just get this off your chest. So finally, she told me that they were bringing cash across the border from Mexico. And I said, well, what's wrong with that? And she said, well, we bring it across and usually in $10,000 increments because it's legal to do that. And I said, so what? I said, why are you agitated about that? And she goes, well, most of the Mexicans pay in cash. And I said, okay, well, so what's the big deal about that? And she goes, well, almost all the Mexicans pay in cash. And so then it clicked in. Mexico was NXIVM's cash cow, and they made millions of dollars in Mexico. And I'm thinking like, oh, holy shit. They're bringing all this cash across the border from Mexico. And I said, Nancy, what are you guys doing with that cash? And she said, well, we're keeping most of it in the safe in my basement. And I said, okay. And she said, and we're not going to pay taxes on it. And I said, okay, that's a problem. And she said, yeah. And I said, how are you going to get rid of all that cash? And she said, we haven't figured that out yet. And then all of a sudden she looks up at me and she said, what are you going to do with this information? Like, I'm trying to be really cool on the outside, but inside I'm just going, you know, the F word over and over and over again, because I know that they have this huge problem, this huge criminal problem on their hands. And I know the size of the safe in the basement, because when they had this house remodeled, she took me on a tour of it. And it's just huge safe in the basement. And inside, I'm like a duck paddling for its life on the water, trying to get away from a predator. But on the outside, I'm just trying to be as cool and calm as I possibly can. And I'm just, she's like looking at me like, what are you going to do with this information? And I'm just like, Nancy, there's nothing I can do with this information. I have no proof. If I left the house and went to the authorities, I have absolutely no proof. Nothing. I said, you have nothing to worry about. The only thing I can say is if I ever got asked on a witness stand, I couldn't lie for you. I'm just not a good liar. I've never been a good liar. I would always get in trouble with my mom when I was growing up. I said, I just can't lie for you. I said, but you have nothing to worry about. And I just did some small talk and I got in my car and I just thought, oh my God, I'm going to be in a cornfield in Iowa by tomorrow morning. Mm-hmm. And then I went home and I had a conversation with my wife about it. And I thought, I cannot support this. It doesn't matter how far in debt I am. I just have to get the hell out of here. And I called Barbara Boucher because she was my coach. And I knew Barbara had one foot in and one foot out. And I said, I can't stay. And I said, I can't tell you why, but I can't stay. I have to leave. And she said, why don't you fly back to Albany? You already have a flight plan to come back. That's when the Dalai Lama had canceled. He was going to come and spend a week and work with Nexium. And he had canceled because he had sent some emissaries out and they had found out bad stuff about Nexium. And he had canceled. And she said, why don't you just fly out and spend some time with me? I have a group of women who have concerns about Nexium. And I said, I don't know if I can do that. But I had a house in Albany and a car in Albany and I had personal belongings in Albany. And I thought it'd be a perfect time to settle affairs and nobody would be wiser to just come back and settle my affairs, get the hell out of Dodge, and then peacefully turn in my resignation and close my center.
In 2009, you were part of the Nexium 9 meeting. What happened at that meeting and why did you videotape it?
There was a group of us that had met for days before that. And we all shared our concerns. And Barbara had had a sexual relationship with Keith for years. And I was pretty sure that she had. So she told me that she had. She told all of us that she had and how it was set up that Pam had approached her. And I thought, oh my God, Pam did the same thing with me with Nancy. And that she'd had a relationship with him. And then she found out, she says now it was years later, but she in the meeting had told us it had been only 4 months later. She found out about the other women. And she said that she only found out about few. That's what she's admitting to now. But in the meeting, she admitted that she knew about several of the other women. And then we all talked about our concerns. All 9 of us talked about our concerns about a lot of things. And I told them about what Nancy had told me about the money laundering and about the Brofman's money and the commodities. Barbara shared that Keith had lost her money and some other people's money in the commodities market. And that I thought it was unethical that Keith was sleeping with students, that Nancy was sleeping with students and stuff like that. And that they were borrowing such large amounts of money from rich students to, you know, keep Nexium afloat and stuff. And so I was already out the door. But Barbara thought if we met with Keith, that maybe Keith could change some things of how the company was running and that we could stay. And I said, I can't stay. I mean, with all the stuff that's going on, I can't support an unethical company, you know, and illegal activities like this. But she convinced me that let's give this a try. And I thought, what the hell? I have nothing to lose, you know? And so I had bought a new camera, an HD camera with a hard drive attached, built into it and stuff. And I had brought it with me because I was learning how to use it and stuff. And I was also doing some film editing stuff. And so I asked Barbara, I said, ask Keith if he would let me film it. Because I thought it would just be interesting to have a copy of the meetings with him. And so she did, and he agreed. And everybody agreed to let me film it. And then we would go back to Barbara's house after the meetings and we would watch the film. And then we would debrief on the film, you know, and kind of come up with our next day strategy of meeting with him. And then it was the end of the second day. I said, I can't do this anymore. You know, I'm done. And actually the third day meeting was just to tell him we were all done and we were going to resign. And that's what the third day meeting was. And then that's when he did his little dog and pony show around that he's had people killed for his beliefs. And when he said that, the hair on the back of my head stood up when we were watching that. And I said, did you guys hear what he said? And people are like, what? And I said, well, let me rewind this because I had my camera hooked up to Barbara's TV. So I played it again. And I said, did you guys catch that? And people are like, what? And I said, well, let me play it one more time. And then I played it and people just kind of said, well, like, so what? And I said, don't you guys remember Kristen Snyder? Don't you guys remember the woman who died at the monastery? You know, and people are like, no, he wouldn't have done. And Barbara was his biggest champion. Like, no, he wouldn't have done that. And I'm like, how the hell do you guys not know? I said, I've been scared to death ever since Nancy told me about all the cash from Mexico that I would end up in a cornfield in Iowa. And then after we left NXIVM, there were cars that followed me. You can tell when you're being followed, when you're being tailed. And then we live across the street from a church. And there was a car that started staying in the church parking lot 24 hours a day. And then every once in a while, another car would come up to the car and two guys, the guy that was in the car would get out and they would both take off. And so one day I got the nerve up to walk up to the car that was left in the church parking lot. It was full of electronics. And I went, oh my God, they're spying on us. We're being surveillanced. Then I called the church. And I said, I live by the church. I didn't tell them exactly where, but I said, I live by your church and there's a car that's parked in your church parking lot. And I said, it's full of electronics. And I said, why is that? And they said, well, we can't divulge why there's a car in our parking lot. And I said, well, I just left a dangerous cult. And I said, I think that car's spying on me. And they said, well, we cannot divulge why that car's in our parking lot. And I said, well, I don't think you guys have a right to let somebody sit in your parking lot and potentially spy on your neighbors. I don't think that's the Christian thing to do. But they said, well, we're sorry, but we cannot divulge why somebody's parked in our parking lot.
When did you start thinking about NXIVM as a dangerous cult and not as sort of some kind of personal growth program?
When Nancy told me about the cash coming across the border and stuff. And then after I left, I hooked up with Tony Natale after I left, Barbara Boucher asked me to go to California with her to meet with Ford Green, an attorney. And then we met with Yuri Plyum. He was the real estate guy. And he told me that he had been threatened several times by Jim Del Negro. And then he told me about the whole takeover of the company. And what had happened with the takeover of the company. And while we were there, we called Tony Natale. And then shortly after that, Barbara had us all come back to New York and she rented a house out by Silver Bay. And while we were at Silver Bay, we found out we were being watched. Barbara had invited Tony Natale to come down. And Tony Natale told us her entire story of everything she had been through. Mm-hmm. You know, he's stealing mail out of her mailbox and her dog being poisoned and all the lawsuits she had been through and stuff like that. And then Tony put us in touch with Joe O'Hara. And then Joe told us all the legal problems he had been through and how a piece of property he had owned had a death threat painted on it. I was going to get sued as soon as I filed for bankruptcy. That they were going to come after me in my bankruptcy. So I didn't have any money to hire an attorney. I mean, as a bankruptcy court. And so I took an online course called How to Win in Court. And then Joe O'Hara helped me and Peter Skolnick helped me. They mentored me on how to be an attorney. And so I spent a lot of time with Tony Natale and Joe O'Hara. So I just slowly started to realize how dangerous they were. They were doing mob activity. You know, what does the mob do when one of their people find out they're doing mob activity? They bump them off. I just thought for sure they were going to kill me.
I think that's understandable. I just want to go back in time to something you said. So you're with a group of women. And you were in the room with Keith Raniere saying that he had people killed for their beliefs. You're the only one in the room that hears it. You had to play it a couple times before everybody heard, or they're listening back to the tape.
Yeah.
So do you think it's like they're hypnotized or sort of like a hypnotic induction type thing that they can't hear it? How could you be the only one to hear that? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, one, I think Barbara Boucher doesn't think Keith would ever harm a fly.
Okay.
To this day. And I think the other people had not spent the kind of time with Nancy Salzman that I had spent. They hadn't been psychologically abused by her. that I had, you know, and they didn't hear about the crimes that they were committing or the unethical behavior, you know, the wasting away of millions and millions of dollars. Although Barbara Boucher was aware of it because they blew through her almost $2 million of commodities and never paid her back, even though they promised to. Well, they paid her cousin back, but they didn't pay Michael Sutton's money back, you know, and Barbara Boucher personally signed for that money and they didn't pay his money back. And then Pam Kayfred's, they blew through a lot of her inheritance in the commodities market. But $68 million of the Brofman's money, just because they have a lot of money, $68 million, and to never give that money back to them. And Barbara was their financial planner. She should have warned them.
It's unbelievable. And she's still loyal. And Claire Brofman's still loyal to Keith to this day. It's amazing.
Well, that's one of the things I said to her in her sentencing. I said, why don't you just close your checkbook to him and you'll find out how much he does care about you?
Yeah, you were the only one in that sentencing that I can remember, okay, saying what we all were thinking. You said, did you ever consider that they were just using you for your money? Everybody's thinking that. I was just, thank you for saying that, because we were, at least everyone I know and talk to, and we're all thinking that, like, how can you not see how you're being used? And there was also a moment in that sentencing where the judge admonished her for manipulating one of her victims. Mm-hmm. Was she using NXIVM techniques on her?
Yeah, she was trying to shame her patient or her shame her victim.
Were you surprised by that?
No.
What was NXIVM suing you for? What did they want? You're in bankruptcy.
What they were going for is to get my bankruptcy thrown out just to punish me is what they were going for. But they claimed over 200 claims, like I was teaching their program after I left, that I wouldn't that I refused to return their materials, even though I had pages and pages and pages between their attorneys and me trying to give their materials back. I tried to give it to the people that remained in that were still active here. Then I tried to extort money out of them by asking for monies that were owed to me after I left for the value of the center that I built here that moved to Vancouver. Vancouver would have been my satellite center had I stayed in.
So in the memorandum decision in your case, references you wanting to report NXIVM mother to protective services. What were your concerns?
Well, that's before we knew that Kristen Keefe was Galen's mother. And so what we did, Joe and Tony and I, we were all told when Galen was born, we were all told that Barbara Jeske had a friend of hers parents, had a daughter who died in a car accident, and the parents couldn't take care of Galen in Michigan. And so they asked Barbara Jeske to raise the child. And they told us this at an intensive. And I'm thinking, like, what? Barbara Jeske can't even take care of her dogs, let alone a kid. And so this kid supposedly came from Michigan across state lines without adoption papers. And then Galen was getting passed around, you know, to nannies, in the Rainbow Cultural Gardens and stuff like that. Then eventually ends up living with Kristen Keefe. And so what Tony and Joe and I did is we got a hold of Child Protective Services and also got a hold of the state troopers in New York State and said, look, this kid came across state lines, because that's the information that we had, from Michigan, and isn't living with the parent that we were told was the child that was supposed to be taking care of it. And so we wanted an investigation done. And so what it came back done as is that Kristen Keefe was the biological parent. Once we found out that Kristen Keefe was the biological parent, then we suspected that Keith Raniere was the father.
And you were correct.
And we were correct.
Also, that same memorandum decision references wanting to report NXIVM for food poisoning at their 2006 Family Values event. What is all this food poisoning about? There's also a story that came out about V-Week in 2016 where everybody got sick but the higher ups? What was that about?
We got a lot of information from people who became disgruntled at NXIVM. So we got a lot of information either through Frank Perlato and stuff like that. And so apparently there was a food poisoning incident at V-Week. What they did was they got a hold of Joe O'Hara's old email server from his ex-employer. And so they found a lot of emails between Joe, Tony, and I that they presented in my court case. So what they were trying to make it look like is we were conspiring against them. And they went over like a lead balloon in my court case. They could never prove conspiracy. Conspiracy to do what, you know?
Right, right. But I was just curious, like, what do you think the aim of that was in 2000? What kind of experiment? Or, I mean, can you even speculate?
That I don't know. But if you recall Dr. Brandon Porter.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
He was doing a lot of experiments. And so we don't know if it was actually a food poisoning event that happened in the kitchen at V-Week and the higher-ups were just eating other foods, or if there was actually an experiment that Brandon Porter did and the higher-ups just ate different food that day. So we were speculating, you know, was it an experiment that Brandon Porter was doing, that he was trying an experiment, or was it actually a kitchen mm-hmm. event?
Yeah.
You know, so we were speculating through email, you know, was there an experiment going on that Brandon Porter was pulling, or was it an actual kitchen event?
Claire Bronfman was deposed in your case.
No, she wasn't deposed in my case. She actually testified.
Thank you.
At my trial. Yeah.
What was she asked about? And did she lie? What were the contents of that testimony?
Well, she came as NXIVM's expert. Gosh, that was so long ago. I asked her about the tech and I asked her about the patents.
So you're representing yourself?
Yes. Yes.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Which was really actually worked in my favor because, you know, like I had to learn how to be an attorney, but like I said, I took that online course. And then we waited as long as we possibly could to, one, I needed some therapy. And then I did take an online course called How to Win in Court. Well, and then I had Joe O'Hara and Peter Skolnick, who was Rick Ross's attorney. They mentored me in like how to write a motion and what a motion to quash was and how to serve a subpoena and things like that. So I did have a lot of help and I had a lot of moral support around me and stuff. And it was my full-time job. It was quite the journey. Matter of fact, both Joe O'Hara and Peter Skolnick said, you should go to law school. And I think I'm done arguing.
Wow.
At the court.
Because, I mean, I saw Claire, you know, say that she found her lawyers in court on Google when they were friends of her family. You know, they came into court later saying we known Claire since she was, you know. So did she perjure herself on the stand, in your opinion?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure she did. It's really funny because I would ask her a yes or no question and then she would talk her way around it. And then I'd have to get the judge to. I'd say, Your Honor, this is a yes or no question. Would you please, you know, ask the witness to answer the question? And he'd look at her and he'd say, Miss Brofman, this is a yes or no question. And so it was interesting to get her painted into a corner, you know, or I would ask her a question and she'd be like, well, he's the vanguard, you know, and be like, that's not really an answer, Miss Brofman. You know, and it's so funny as she doesn't even have a high school education and for them to send her out to be NXIVM's, you know, and like I asked her a question about, you know, how many modules are in, you know, the 16-day training. She came up with this bizarre answer. And I said, well, where did you get that information from? And she said, my attorney. And I looked at her attorney and I looked at her and I said, well, when did your attorney become the NXIVM expert, you know? Isn't this something you should know as the NXIVM expert?
Who was her attorney at that time? Did she go through a few attorneys or did she, who represented her? Do you remember?
They had seven attorneys on the case, but Bob Crockett from Latham & Watkins was their big head cheese. But then they had two.
Is that the Mormon? Am I?
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. And I didn't know this at the time, but he spent most of the time on his iPad looking at his daughter's wedding pictures.
And he was very much a part of working against gay marriage in California. That was one of his big projects. So, and when she would come to court, she really dressed down.
Yeah.
Do you think that's about sort of emulating the vanguard in his, and how he was sort of like what you'd call, I come from a, you know, showbiz background, the talent. So he dresses like the talent, you know, dresses down the artist or whatever. Do you think she was emulating that? Or do you think, what is all her, you know, coming to court, like dressed like a schlub about?
Yeah, you know, I don't know for her. She's never been a real fancy dresser. You know, it's funny because when I first met her, her sister was the more popular one in NXIVM. You know, Sara was more bubbly and more out there and more popular. And she was more the wallflower kind of person. And they really played the girls off of each other to see who they could squeeze the most money out of, I think. But Sara was really the more popular one out of the two of them. And Claire was really into riding her horses. Like she would get up really early in the morning and train and stuff like that before she would come to a level two training and stuff like that. So I try to like connect with her, because that's kind of like what I did, is I try to connect to the people that weren't really the popular ones. I try to connect to her on the fact that we shared a somewhat similar background in horse showing and stuff like that. And she was such a snob about it. But nobody would talk to her. So at least I was trying to talk to her and connect with her and stuff like that.
Your victim impact statement, you called her a predator. I mean, do you think she's a victim of Ranieri, or is she, in your opinion, a victimizer, or both?
Well, I think that there's a fine line. I think when people cross the line and create criminal activity, they stop being a victim.
Okay. Do you think the right people were prosecuted in this case?
Well, I think the right people were prosecuted. I think there's more people out there that weren't, but you know, the DOJ has to cut off the line somewhere. Like Jim Del Negro, I think Jim Del Negro created a lot of crimes for them. You know, I think there's other people, the Mexicans, you know, there's a lot of people in Mexico that committed crimes for them, but you know, it's hard to extradite, especially when, you know, your father's ex-president of Mexico, you know, that kind of thing. So I think there's other criminals out there that probably won't be prosecuted.
The Keith Ranieri sentencing, you talked about his followers saying, who knows what he will create next, using them as a weapon of destruction. And while Keith Ranieri was in jail, the group was created, Make Justice Blind. Who do you think was funding that?
You know, that's really hard to say where that money's coming from. I think probably some of it's coming from Mexico. You know, I don't think that Claire is stupid enough to keep funding it. I think her money's being very closely monitored in regards to that. She's got, you know, a lot of things to worry about. You know, she's caught participating and stuff like that. It's going to make her appeal really difficult. I don't know if Sara's participating. Sara is very frugal with her money. I know that from just working with her in Ireland. So I can't imagine that Sara is participating in it from any perspective. And hopefully she's found her way out, but she might be, but some of it could be coming from Mexico. There's still a lot of diehards in Mexico, especially if you read the support letters for Keith and Claire. A lot of them come from Mexico.
Do you think that the NXIVM could be reinvented without Ranieri's influence? Do you think that would be a good idea?
You mean that the overall curriculum? Mm-hmm. Yeah, gosh, you know, I think it's so tainted that it would be difficult to reinvent it. I think some of the manipulation that went on behind it, it's you know, I've always used the analogy of, you know, the knife in a hand of a surgeon is really healing, but the knife in a hand of a murderer is, you know, deadly. And so trying to reinvent it, it depends on who's holding the knife kind of thing. It's just so hard to imagine somebody picking it up and doing good things with it. It's so funny because when we left Keith, I said, you know, would you ever consider letting somebody teach the program and rebranding it without you being involved and without the sashes and stuff like that? And he said, absolutely not. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. And what do you think, I mean, do you think we'll ever, that Keith Ranieri will ever stop trying to get in the spotlight from jail or prison, wherever he's at?
I think it depends on how long people want to report on him. You know, I think it would be good that people just forget about him. That's a big thing. And I told Frank Perlotta that, you know, he called me, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago. We just check in with each other periodically. And because he was, you know, he's been reporting on the NXIVM 5, the people that still support him. And I said, you know, it would be good to just let them heal. You know, people stop giving them platform to say how innocent he is. And because if people stop giving them attention, then, and they stop giving Keith attention, then he'll be forgotten. And then people can actually heal at some point and stop telling his story. And then I think once his appeals are exhausted, I don't know. He's saying that he'll be killed in prison, but I don't know if that's true. I mean, I don't know how things are in prison from that perspective, but I wouldn't put it past him committing suicide.
Really? That's interesting. And what do you think brought NXIVM down? I mean, if they hadn't branded women, would they have continued on, you think?
I think if Keith wouldn't have started DOS, probably would still be in business. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. The whole collateral, the whole branding, the whole sex cult. You know, it's like a lot of people have wanted to focus in on the sex cult of NXIVM, but there was so many bad things about that. I mean, just the emotional abuse that took place. Like a lot of people have focused in on Keith, but they haven't focused in on Nancy.
I agree. Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
That's what I've been talking to the Vow about. You know, I said, you guys have spent so much time focusing on Keith, but he was just one element of the bad in there. I said, you guys haven't even dove into Nancy yet. And I said, she abused so many people, but sex is the sizzle that sells, you know, in so many ways. So
do you think your story has been more ignored because it's not part of the DOS story of NXIVM?
I don't think it's just my story that's been ignored. I think Nancy abused a lot of people. Well, Barbara was sued, but she was sued by Keith and NXIVM in the Brofmans. And then Rick Ross was sued, you know, and then Tony was sued. There was a lot of abuse through litigation. A lot of that hasn't been covered either.
Well, Susan, that's just because NXIVM didn't have adult lawyer supervision. That's why they were desperately in need of it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And the judge was right, you know, if they would have just gone to the next attorney firm.
Do you agree with the sentences do you think Claire got a fair sentence?
Personally, I don't think Claire got a fair plea deal. I think they went after the money. And hopefully that money will do some good. But I think she should have got a stiffer plea deal.
You mean more time?
Well, I think the plea deal she got, the things that she got to plead guilty to, wasn't fair. She should have got a stiffer plea deal. Then she would have got more time.
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. Have you heard anything about how she's doing or how she's faring?
Just other than what's been on the Frank report, that's all I've heard about how she's doing. I mean, she's continued to lose weight.
Continue to lose weight, Susan? How is that even possible?
You know, she's stayed a vegan, and it's hard to be a vegan in jail because they don't cater to vegans, you know, where Keith didn't cater to the vegetarian diet. So he started to eat the meat and stuff. And so there's not much for her to eat there. She has lost some weight there.
Where did that veganism, is that just from something from Claire or is that in NXIVM? Because
that's something that's her thing.
Okay. I guess we've already touched on a little bit, but is there anything that you think is really important to the story that the media is not reporting on?
I think that they're missing the boat with Nancy. I think that's the big thing that they're not really focusing on. Everybody's focusing in on Keith. And Keith could have never done it on his own. I mean, he truly needed a pack of women to accomplish what he accomplished. Keith was the idea man. Nobody did anything without Keith's approval, but he could have never done it by himself. He needed a group of women to do his ideas. It's kind of like Charles Manson. You know, people focused in on Charles Manson, but they didn't really focus in on the people that did his bidding. I mean, in the movies, they focused in on the people that did the killing for him. But the same thing's happening in the Vow. They've focused in on Keith's behavior, but they haven't focused in really on the people who actually did the behavior. You know, Lauren and Nancy and some of the people from Mexico, that kind of stuff, and how that rippled out throughout the community and the people that really truly affected. You know, they're just focusing in on DOS. And that was last 3 years of Nexium. They're missing a whole group of people that really got abused.
And how do you heal from something like this?
It takes time. You know, it takes a lot of therapy and stuff because the triggers run deep. I've talked to my therapist about this, you know, because it needs to be talked about. And if you don't talk about it, then people don't become aware of it. And I feel a responsibility to talk about it. And so I think there's healing in going to the sentencings, and I think there's healings in talking about it. And I think there's healings in, you know, being a part of some of the shows that are out there and stuff like that. And I think it's an important part in educating the public about it so that if it just saves one person from getting involved, I think it's worth it to have a responsibility to be part of the educational forum in doing this. And then it allows a deeper healing to it. And part of it's a time element. And then also it's exploring things that feed my soul. You know, like I love music. And so music's a part of it. And then, you know, gardening is a part of my healing process and stuff. And so it's finding things that feed my soul, that I new things that I enjoy, and then old things that were a part of my life before all of this happened, not ignoring it. Like I know people that just say, I just want to move on with my life. And I'm like, it's not that easy. I used to talk about this in Nexium when I would do intros. It's kind of like a beach ball. You try to hold this beach ball underneath the water and you pretend like it doesn't exist. But it takes a certain amount of life force energy that you hold underneath the water. And then when it pops up to the surface, you know, you frantically try to put it underneath the water. And maybe you like say, oh, well, I'll get a net and I'll put the ball in the net and I'll tie it to my leg. And so you have better ball management, but it still exists in your body. And so I think exploring the beach ball and taking the air out of it and putting it alongside the pool helps you have a better quality of life. Sometimes it gets inflated and gets back in the pool and you're like, oh, that's interesting. You know, I thought I took care of that ball. And then you go like, oh, you know, I didn't do all the work yet. And so instead of being afraid of the ball, you just go like, oh, well, you know, it's time to go back to therapy and explore this ball a little bit more. So instead of being afraid of it, just embrace it and deal with it. And so I found a really good therapist, you know, I love her to death. And so I just work with her and, you know, she's there when I need to. And, you know, I have a very loving partner and I have a loving cat that, you know, takes good care of me when I need her to take care of me. And I take care of her when she needs to be taken care of. So there's just different ways of dealing with that. And then I think forgiveness has been a big part of it. And people think forgiveness is about the other person. And it isn't. It's really about you. And so I pray for them.
Susan Jones, thank you so much. It's been fascinating.
Oh, you're so welcome. Yeah, thanks for giving me time to have my voice with you.
Anytime.